Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council calls for a 150-day halt to new data centers so they can gather more facts.
When we can agree on the facts, then we can talk about good policy.
Meanwhile, State Attorney General Jeff Jackson speaks out about data centers.
They use massive amounts of energy. They strain the entire system.
And calls for a separate set of electric rates for those centers. The South Carolina primary effectively ends the political careers of Rock Hill's Ralph Norman and Nancy Mace as they lose their bids to be candidates for governor in the fall. Mace throws her support to a former foe.
So tonight, I want you to know that I'm going to endorse Alan Wilson for governor.
And the Carolina Hurricanes win again. They keep skating toward the Stanley Cup. Here to fill us in on those stories and more, WFAE climate reporter Zachary Turner is here. David Hodges is an investigative reporter for WBTV. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter at the Charlotte Observer. And Hunter Sines, fresh off the anchor desk, reporter for WSOC-TV. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Always like to embarrass Hunter. So I'm going to... I'm going to start with a story we didn't even tease because it just happened late yesterday afternoon, Mary, and that is the fact that the legislature, there's a bill being proposed by Vicki Sawyer in the legislature that, if passed, would require Charlotte and all of the area towns that voted to put a stop to the toll lanes to pay back the money already spent. How much money are we talking about?
Yes, so NCDOT had spent about $60 million on this project before the CRTPO voted to essentially pull out of the idea.
So if it's approved, and I'm not sure, is this a separate bill or is this part of another bill?
This is actually an amendment to a tangential bill, House Bill 1094, which is about auditing the State Department of Transportation's ferry division.
And according to a story in both that we reported on FAE and also a story in the Charlotte Observer, if this is approved, not only would we be paying back $60 million, it could force elected officials to actually change their minds about this because they don't want to pay back the $60 million, and it would bring the project back to life. What are the chances of that? Do we know?
Well, it kind of remains to be seen. As you mentioned, this was a late-breaking story yesterday. Obviously, it was huge news when local governments rescinded their support for this project. That move came after weeks of community pushback, a lot of organization in the community in opposition to this project and the potential impacts was seen as a real kind of victory for the community activist crowd and for a lot of neighborhoods who had organized in opposition. But we'll see if this is enough to pressure Charlotte and everybody else to come back to the negotiating table.
Go ahead, Zach.
I was going to say, I think we've heard so far from City Council member Malcolm Graham, who said he would wait to take a look at the amendment before making a decision. And it looks like Charlotte's not going to be expecting any help from the governor, who gave a pretty equivocal response in response to the appearance of this amendment, that omnibus bill.
The amendment also says that the Department of Transportation shall withhold state funds for new highway projects in our area until that money is paid back if this passes. And it also could block NCDOT from removing the project from its prioritization list until next year. We're set to lose, what, $700 million in highway funds if we don't go forward with this? And they're talking about putting that in abeyance until this is decided. Is that what that means?
That's my understanding, yes.
So Republican State Senator Vicki Sawyer, who represents Iredell County and parts of Mecklenburg County, proposed this. Why?
Yeah, so she has not responded to requests for comment. David, I know you mentioned you had heard it. It's actually kind of something in a little bit of contrast.
Yeah. So far I haven't seen any quotes from her after this story started breaking, but I actually interviewed her on May 21st after this whole entire I-77 project fell apart. And I went back and read my story because when I saw this great reporting from The Observer and others, it kind of struck out to me. She literally told me that she's hopeful the North Carolina General Assembly doesn't get overly involved in the local debate. And she told me she supports Charlotte and wants to make sure the funding doesn't get moved. So to now see reporting where that she is putting forward this amendment to remove all this funding and even make Charlotte and other towns pay back, do not, those things don't really seem to jive at all. So I know we're going to keep reaching out to her for sure.
It seems like a $60 million slap on the wrist for going against kind of the maybe more traditional way in which city council has been in the past, more along business interests, maybe a more cooperative with NCDOT.
Well, they can't say they weren't warned. This came up in discussions before they made the vote to not go forward with this. Okay, so we'll stay tuned to that. Data centers are the topic of conversation all over the country, all of a sudden with calls for moratorium on building future centers despite the growing need for them. Concerned citizens here are part of a growing chorus calling for a hold, and this week Charlotte City Council gave them what they wanted. They listened. In a unanimous vote, they put a 150-day hold on approving more of these data centers. Mary, this has been building. Was it unexpected, or is this just the natural course of events?
Think the passage was entirely unexpected. I was a little surprised that it was a unanimous vote. There were a couple folks on council who seemed a little more open-minded, for lack of a better phrase, to data centers. And obviously, this is a 150-day moratorium, not a permanent ban. So we'll see where things end up in about 5 months. But a lot of that, as council pointed out, is also going to be dependent on what the state legislature ends up doing on data centers, how much authority they're willing to give municipalities to restrict these projects. And also worth noting, this moratorium only applies to projects that haven't already started. So that means the contentious proposed facility out near the Reedy Creek Nature Preserve in East Charlotte is paused, but there are some other facilities that had already been approved in the Charlotte area that will keep moving forward despite the moratorium on new projects.
City Council's Victoria Watlington echoed what some other members of council have been saying for quite a while, that they need more information before going forward.
When we can agree on the facts, then we can talk about good policy. And I think that that's exactly what this 150-day moratorium will do, is give us an opportunity to come to the table together to review and understand and align on the facts, and then decide what's best for our community, because ultimately we determine how it grows.
What might they learn in this 150-day pause that they don't already know?
Well, I think there's a big issue surrounding data centers in terms of transparency. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know about data centers, such as unless they offered this information voluntarily through a sustainability report, we don't know how much water they're using, we don't know how much energy that they're using. And so these are definitely issues that involve kind of the general public because, data centers can use a lot of electricity, they can use a lot of water. We are a state that has been in many, many months of consecutive drought. So it is something that, city council can do like in-state policies that allow for more transparency. I know lawyers from the SELC have put forth a proposal that they could create a special use permit that would create this sort of separate forum for the public to be able to engage with this issue when there are new data centers coming into town that would be outside of this traditional sort of rezoning request. Because right now, that's really the main time that folks can get involved and express their dissent if there's a data center coming in nearby, like we've seen with this East Charlotte data center.
And these moratoria are being called for and enacted all over the country, all over the state. The city of Nashville, Tennessee, is also considering a 150-day moratorium on these things. Why now? Why is this all of a sudden coming to a head in the same way?
I think there's been a lot of increased attention because as technology has advanced, particularly the growth of AI, these data centers are getting bigger and they're also moving closer to populated areas. So people are starting to take notice, whereas this might have been a smaller facility with less potential environmental impacts in a more industrial part of town, say 10 years ago. It's now more likely to be bigger and closer to, neighborhoods where people are actually going to see and feel the impacts and are going to, as Zach said, turn out to those rezoning hearings and ask questions and push back.
Right, because there are much larger data centers under construction right now that have already been approved for their rezoning requests. Like there's the Digital Realty data center just north of the airport that I believe is, many orders of magnitude larger than this one in East Charlotte that has generated a lot of public pushback. We've also got one in the University City area that's already under construction. It's just more the location of some of these proposed data centers as they're moving closer to more residential areas.
Mayor Lyles blocked a previous attempt to put a pause on data centers here. Did this happen now because she is literally weeks from retirement?
That, and also I think there's been a string of kind of new progressive blood in city council, and I think we've kind of seen this represented in the I-77 vote. We're seeing it in the data center moratorium. There are some folks that are maybe latching onto some of the kind of more, you know, populist sort of topics like this data center moratorium and the pushback against expanding the toll lanes on I-77.
City Council's Dimple Ashmera made the observation that this is not a partisan issue. It is a quality of life issue. And she says this is about clean air and clean water. But this is also a big business issue. So how did it escape from being partisan when so many other big business issues, particularly when they relate to climate, have become so?
I think that's a trend we're seeing nationwide. I can't remember if it was either a New York Times story or a Washington Post story I read in recent weeks about communities in Wisconsin, for example, where you've got, you know, people who are normally figuratively speaking at each other's throats at meetings and rallies over their politics were banding together to lobby against data centers. I think, you know, these is sort of a real kitchen table issue in the sense that it's things that people see and feel in their neighborhoods. And that's one of the few things left where people are willing to kind of cast aside those partisan dispersions and band together to push back.
Yeah, I think data centers have kind of become this boogeyman that people are projecting a lot of their misgivings with local government onto. They, you know, they're seeing this like sort of resentment towards what they feel like are closed-door deals going on behind the scenes. They're not hearing about these projects until these rezoning petitions, and they feel like there's a lot of work that's been going on without them knowing. And people are frustrated with that. They want to see more transparency. They want to see more accountability in government, and data centers have kind of taken that on as a topic. I don't think that it had to be data centers, but that's sort of what they've become.
It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Another council member, J.D. Mazuras Arias, pointed out that data centers can be built right now, before this pause, in 7 different zoning districts in Charlotte and approved without very much scrutiny. So is a change in that likely to be something that comes out of this pause? Would it be a rules change limiting where they can be located or how much energy or water they can use or how big these facilities can be? Will there be hoops to be jumped through, in other words?
We saw that. Mary, do you want to go ahead?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, I think that's probably one of the more tangible ways, as Zach was alluding to earlier, zoning and rezoning requests and those ordinances are sort of the main avenue local governments have for regulating these facilities. That being said, we're waiting to see what kind of moves in Raleigh before knowing fully what the city will and won't be allowed to do to regulate these kind of facilities.
Yeah. Why are these, why are they allowed? Why are there no zoning regulations about where they can be located? Seemingly.
There's been a lot of, and I'm not fully read up on the by right zoning rules, but my understanding is that based on the type of zoning for certain parcels or certain areas, data centers are just, they kind of fall under that broad category of what you're allowed to build without filing for a separate like rezoning request. So that's, I think, why some folks have advocated for doing like a special use permit or creating their own zoning category. What we've heard in these public meetings and what we've heard from city staff is based on some recent North Carolina legislation, you can no longer downzone. You cannot change zoning to be more restrictive, so you would have to create new rules to apply to these facilities.
Of course, you've already mentioned some of the concerns with regard to water usage and power consumption, and that also relates to power rates going up in many places. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about that because Duke Energy faced some questions over data centers and their favorability in the company's eyes. We'll do that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup. Zachary Turner's with us. He's our climate reporter at WFAE News. Hunter Sines is here from WSOC-TV. Right across the way there is his keen competition, David Hodges, with WBTV, and Mary Ramsey staying out of the whole thing. She's the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We were talking about data centers and the 150-day moratorium that Charlotte City Council has imposed on future data centers. They are also on council referring people to the General Assembly, where a bill is being considered to put more restrictions on those centers, as Mary referred to a moment ago. And among those calling on the North Carolina Utilities Commission to do something about data centers is State Attorney General Jeff Jackson.
They use massive amounts of energy. They strain the entire system. And going into this new era, we need specific protections to make sure that families don't see rates spike because of gigantic users on the grid.
So, Zachary, what is he asking the Utilities Commission to do?
Yeah, so Jackson is asking for the Utility Commission to basically create new rates for data centers and other large load customers, customers that are using energy on a scale that is just so much larger than other power users. I think I've seen some suggestions for new rates for customers that use over 100 megawatts of demand. And they also set some restrictions around, like, or setting some specifications around how often they're using these power. Because what sets data centers apart from a lot of other energy users is how often they require power. So if they need that energy more than 80% of the time, then this new rate class would apply to them. And the whole reason he's doing this is because he wants to make sure, or what he's saying is that he wants to make sure that the cost to providing energy to these customers is properly allocated, and you don't have residential customers paying for new power plants that were built because we have a bunch of new data centers coming to the state.
And Duke Energy Carolinas is already requesting a 14% rate hike starting next year. Are data centers and the need to improve the infrastructure to support them a reason or the reason for that request?
In this case, no. I mean, what we're talking about is, like, when we're having this discussion about data centers and rates and these power plants, we're talking about rate cases that haven't started yet. It just happens that we have two rate cases right now with the Utility Commission involving Duke Energy, but what they're paying for now are costs that they've already incurred for the last few years. This is like storm repair, this is grid hardening, this is improving distribution systems and transmission systems. It doesn't have to do with the kind of data centers, the hyperscale data centers, and the proposed projects that we've seen yet. This is something that we're talking about when we're planning for future rate cases down the line.
There's an organization called the Public Staff that's also asking for new rates for data centers, separate rates for data centers. David Williamson is one of the engineers for that organization. He pointed to precedent for this approach as the result of something that Dominion Energy did here in North Carolina to serve owners of electric vehicles.
Generally, they'll have cheaper pricing periods in the middle of the night so that to try and encourage overnight charging as opposed to on a summer day, 5 p.m. during the peak periods.
As the owner of an electric vehicle, I wish that the Duke Energy would do that. having lower rates when demand is low and encouraging electrical vehicle or owners to take advantage of those rates by charging during non-peak hours, I suppose, is one thing, but having a different set of rates for one type of business is another. Is that an apples-to-apples comparison?
Well, I think it's a good explanation for what a tariff is and what it can do. You know, he's explaining a tariff that's in kind of trying to encourage a type of consumer behavior, whether it's small businesses or residents who have EVs. Duke Energy would like to see them charging these cars at the middle of the night when people aren't using a lot of energy, not in the afternoon when everyone's trying to blast their AC when they get home from work. Yeah. But in this case, when we're talking about a tariff for data centers, we're mainly worried about consumer protections, setting a sort of like what the public staff, what Attorney General Jeff Jackson would like to see is a tariff that is applied uniformly across the board for a certain type of customer, a large data center and large customers that need power a lot of the time and a lot of it. In a way that, you know, makes sure that, you know, if they bail out early, they're going to pay some of these costs that were incurred in order to build power plants to support that need. Because the amount of energy they're asking for potentially would require new power plants, whether it's new natural gas, new solar farms, and eventually new nuclear power plants down the road.
Is this dual structure, this dual rate structure for certain kinds of businesses, including data centers that consume enormous amounts of power, something that's being done elsewhere in the country, or is this something new?
Yes, it is being done around the country. I think we've seen this happen with Dominion in Virginia more recently, but already other utilities have adopted tariffs.
So state regulators are still debating Duke's proposed carbon plan amid the controversy and data centers and rising utility bills. And NC warns Matthew Quinn spoke with WFAE. He had questions about Duke's role in data center development.
Duke has... in the recent past, engaged on an economic development campaign designed to bring economic development into the state, including data centers.
And that even as Duke Energy's Kendall Bowman told WFAE that data centers aren't the only factors driving the state's growing energy needs.
There's also a lot of population growth. North Carolina is one of the fastest growing states. Charlotte's the fastest growing city in the country just recently.
And as a sidebar, this increased demand is coming at the very same time, Zach, that state regulators have halted Duke Energy's procurement of new solar farms. North Carolina ranks fifth in the country for installed solar capacity with enough generation to power more than 1.2 million homes. Why halt further development when the need for power is rising, and for how long are they suggesting we halt it?
It's a perplexing decision. I haven't been able to get a comment from the Utility Commission about why they issued this particular order. My understanding, I think, based on the order, is that they wanted to wait and see, you know, what kind of shakes out in the current carbon plan. We've seen a lot of interesting dissenting opinions from one particular commissioner, Commissioner Vandervaart, in a lot of solar procurement cases where he's saying, you know, we should rely more on our coal fleet that we've already got instead of trying to procure the solar. We should add battery storage to these solar facilities. And so they're hitting pause until they can come to another consensus.
And with energy costs continuing to rise, this is another area for concern. You spoke, Zach, with Sean Gallagher, the vice president of the Solar Energy Industry Association, who is obviously biased, but he told you that he thinks this pause could cause a rise in rates.
The pause will increase the risk of a supply crunch that raises North Carolinians' bills.
So who will decide and when will they decide to approve or not approve Duke Energy's carbon plan?
Absolutely. Yeah, right. This past week has been an important milestone in that decision, but there's no firm date. Could be any time before the end of the year when they'll make that decision. In the meantime, they're not going to start construction on any new solar.
Meanwhile, some good news from Piedmont Natural Gas, which is owned by Duke Energy. After a winter of high heating bills, Piedmont has lowered rates. Why?
They're doing this to reflect the cost of natural gas as they have purchased it. So, you know, it went down for them, and they are requesting, they lowered rates 4.35%. That took place on June 1st. So good news for folks that use natural gas.
Yes. Meanwhile, Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles' resignation is set to take effect at the end of the month, and recently City Council began taking applications for her replacement. David, how many individuals are clamoring for this job?
114 people in total applied, and as of yesterday, I was told that 69 are actually eligible, and all 69 have been extended the opportunity to speak to City Council on Monday, which could be a long, long day.
I hope there's a time limitation on how long they can talk. This would be to fill out the remainder of Vi Lyles' term. Council will make the selection. Her replacement must be from her party, so they must be a Democrat. What other requirements, Mary, are there, if there are any?
You have to be 21 or older, and you have to live in the city of Charlotte, so pretty wide net.
Former Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts was the first person to say she wanted the job. I think among the early front runners would be City Council's James Smudgy Mitchell, who also expressed interest and submitted a PowerPoint presentation in which he promised a lot of perks for council members right now. Who are some of the other people who have submitted their names for consideration, if they have names that we would recognize?
Well, I mean, some of them might not be names that are recognizable to a lot of the audience, but could end up becoming front runners. So if you're all right with them, I'll list them anyways. You have Mike Evans, who's a former campaign manager for Vi Lyles and others. Harold Cogdell Jr., former council member and county commissioner. Kerry Cook, who works for the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond and community development. And then someone who applied late, Robert Harrington, who's an attorney and all the current president of the North Carolina Bar Association. Again, what I think is going to be interesting is council wants someone who's going to promise they won't run again. They want someone who can effectively run these meetings and maybe even someone who has enough baggage where if they do decide to run again, they might not win. So that'll be interesting to see.
You also have late in the game was State Senator Caleb Tedros. And I think an important factor, because we saw some people go against what the Black Political Caucus wanted with the I-77 vote here recently when they chose to rescind that. But it's important to note that the Black Political Caucus will meet on Sunday to talk about who they would want as the interim as well.
And when will this decision be made?
June 22nd. I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right around the corner. 10 days. After months of debate, Charlotte City Council has done something the General Assembly has not. It passed a budget, which includes pay raises. The original proposal called for 7% raises for Charlotte Fire and 10% raises for CMPD. In the end, Council decided on 10% all around for both groups. Councilwoman Dimple Ajmera explained that decision this way to WBTV.
We do not want to pit one group against the other. Public safety is a team sport. We need both fire and police to collaborate, and this shows our commitment to public safety.
So David, council also gave themselves and whomever holds the job of mayor next a raise. How much?
It was about, I think it was 9.6% for council and about 14% for the mayor, which actually only comes out to about $4,000 plus for each. That's specific to their salary. Council and the mayor's office also have an expense account, an auto allowance, and technology budget. So that's not money they necessarily get in their pockets, but if they spend money on things that are reimbursable, such as travel for the city or certain types of technology, driving, they can get those expenses. The salary is what particularly increased, and like I said, it's about a little more than $4,000.
And council members released lists of their taxpayer-funded expenses just hours before they voted this pay raise. Was that coincidental, and what did those expense reports show?
I made it a little bit not coincidental. Mike, I requested those records about a month ago just because council is about to vote on pay raises for themselves, as well as council's tasked with appointing Charlotte's next mayor. It's important to see, we've requested this records before, other reporters have requested these records, seeing where council members are traveling, what they believe are travel trips that are worth expensing to taxpayers. They show a lot of different trips to a lot of different places, and I'm gonna be emailing some council members today asking for their comment on those. So stay tuned with WBTV for updates on that.
Thanks for the plug. To fund those raises and more, you could expect a property tax increase. How much?
1.89 cents, which we'll just get to the average for your typical family, which would be about $60 a year, I believe, for the average household.
So we talk a lot on this program and others about Charlotte being the most expensive city in the state in which to live. We talk about the dearth of affordable housing. We talk about inflation in the face of stagnant wages. We know the sales tax is going to go up in July to fund transportation improvements. Now a property tax increase in the city. There's going to be one in from the county, not this year, but likely next year. And there was some pushback to all of this from some on council. Republican Ed Driggs, the only Republican on council, opposed the tax increase.
And there are many people on both sides of the aisle who are fundamentally opposed to a tax increase. And I think I have an obligation to them not to support this budget, even while I appreciate, express my appreciation for its qualities.
So the vote on this budget and the raises for council and mayor and the tax increase was not unanimous. Who else voted for or against it?
Councilmember Luana Mayfield was the other person who voted against it, I believe. Otherwise, it was a 9-2 vote in favor.
Okay. It's the local news roundup this morning with Zachary Turner, David Hodges, Mary Ramsey, and Hunter Sines on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE's Charlotte Talks. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board has adopted its first policy addressing student free speech. Zach, why now?
Yeah, there were a couple of, I guess, high-profile free speech-related incidents at CMS, one involving a Charlie Kirk-related message that was, I believe, painted on a spirit rock at Ardrey Kells, and another one were some student protests regarding the ICE operations, ICE raids in Charlotte last November.
So what does this new policy do?
Yeah, so this is setting up a framework, I guess, for schools. Right now, I believe there's an ongoing lawsuit involving the Spirit Rock case in which the student, I guess, the artwork that was posted on the rock was characterized as vandalism. The student is saying that this was like an act of free speech. They want to have that protected. And so that this free speech policy is basically setting a framework for these areas of free expression on campus or on these schools. So that, you know, I guess setting kind of like that, a basic like framework for other CMS schools. It also talks about the ways in which protests on school grounds can be handled, where they can take place, and like what's sort of allowed.
And it seems to be relatively favorable toward protecting students' rights. It protects students from discipline because of what they've done in terms of speech. It includes political and religious expression as long as it doesn't disrupt instruction, as long as it isn't vulgar, and as long as it doesn't promote drug use and doesn't infringe on other students' rights. It seems pretty broad and positive.
Yeah, I think some of the students were pushing back, saying it was maybe a little too broad to actually be protective of some of the protest elements there. And the certainly the parameters around like what is considered a class disruption could be used to still take protests and move them to areas of the school that are maybe less visible. And that was the concern of some of the students.
Okay. We have run into a problem here because we are 1 minute away from a break, and I don't want to launch into a story. This has never happened before in the entire history of this program, but I don't want to launch into a story that we cannot finish in the time allotted. So we're here on the local news roundup with Zachary Turner, our climate reporter at WFAE News. David Hodges is an investigative reporter for WBTV. Hunter Sines is an anchor reporter for WSOC-TV. And Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. They're all antsy to find out what's next. Well, I'll tell you what's next. We will talk about transit safety issues when we come back and the fact that DeCarlos Brown has been declared incompetent to stand trial at the federal level for the alleged murder of Rena Zarutska last August on the Blue Line. And we'll cover the outcome of the governor's race in the primary in South Carolina when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We're going to talk about safety on transit because it continues to be a concern despite CMPD reports that crime on transit is down.
If you don't back the f*** up, I'm going to f*** you up. I'm going to f*** you up.
That is sound from a video that began circulating online on Tuesday, appearing to show a man wielding a knife during a heated exchange on Sunday night with passengers on the Blue Line. I want to stress no one was injured, but a man with a knife on the train is disturbing. Hunter, what can you tell us about this incident?
Yeah, so we spoke to the person who actually shot that video. It was actually his first time on the light rail system. He was visiting
his last?
arguably, perhaps. He was visiting from out of town. So what a greeting by the city of Charlotte Transportation. And he was nervous that he was going to have to step in this whole thing. I mean, when you watch the video, like you said, it is very disturbing. You see other people around on the light rail system. This was between two men, and there was a woman involved as well that appeared to be associated with one of those men. The guy who shot the video told us that this all started as an argument. like we see a lot of these things happen, and a knife was pulled out. Like you said, thankfully, everybody was safe at the end of the day, got off the train, went their separate ways. 911 actually was never called, which was kind of surprising to me. And so they didn't have like an incident report of this, but Katz and police say they are investigating. We asked Katz, of course, how was this able to happen? Of course, in light of all of the transit problems that we've had, they said that they did have security, both off-duty CMPD officers and their private security working the transit system that night. However, yet again, was not on this specific train like we've seen in the past where incidents happen.
And we've been told that that will never happen. They will never have enough money to put a police or a security officer in every car on every train every day all the time. Katz published a statement about this that included this paragraph. Quote, with the passage of the city budget last night, Katz will continue receiving 1,400 hours of CMPD off-duty support each week and be able to fund a dedicated fare enforcement unit with the contract going to City Council for approval on June 22nd. CMPD and PSS, which I guess is their private security firm, personnel on Sunday evening, though not on this, we're working on Sunday evening, though not on this specific train car at this time. There will never be enough money for that, and we're using off-duty CMPD police. Why aren't CMPD just part of it all the time?
I believe it's because they've wanted to keep it separate. We've had a problem, as we know, with not enough officers on the department. There have been recruiting problems that I will give CMPD credit. The recruitment of its officers, we have actually made pretty good progress here in the last couple of years. But if we talk about why we have always had separation on who is patrolling our light rail system, I'm sure that has been a factor. Another thing has been, this is all contracted with other entities. So Katz, even though it is under the umbrella of the city of Charlotte, it still has its operators are contracted and are not actual city employees. So it's a weird umbrella system.
So do we know if this incident was between random individuals or did they know each other?
That we do not know.
Okay. Katz is also saying that they are evaluating AI-based safety technologies. What do we know about that?
So we've seen this in other cities where specifically we've had a problem in which somebody is banned from the light rail system for whatever reason, but they still continue to get on. That is a big concern that hasn't been dealt with here necessarily, besides putting on more private security with BOLO alerts to try to identify them. AI can be used, kind of facial recognition, to alert the system that, hey, this person who's been banned was just seen on the platform about to get on or trying to get on. So that's one way that it could be used.
CMPD says that crime is down on transit, and it is true that you can never completely eliminate danger everywhere all the time, but the Observer analyzed federal and local data, interviewed experts, and found that Katz Light Rail is not significantly more dangerous than other light rail systems around the country, but Katz bus drivers are three times as likely to be assaulted than the average bus driver nationwide. Mary, I don't know much you know about this, but this is an Observer story. Do we understand why bus drivers are seemingly in more jeopardy?
Yeah, so this is something my colleague Caitlin McGlade at the Observer has done a great job diving into, really the data of all this, and pointing out that while the system, as you mentioned, is relatively safe compared to other cities, the issues are popping up a lot more on buses, even though light rail tends to get a little more conversation. And it's oftentimes these bus drivers, and just some really harrowing accounts from these drivers as well as their loved ones, you know, loved ones feeling like their family member who's a bus driver, safety is at risk, and, you know, similar to how they would feel if they were a law enforcement officer or something like that, you know, saying phrases like, I pray that they come home at night. So definitely a lot of data in there, and great work from Caitlin on that.
David and Hunter want to get in on this. David, you were first. Go ahead.
Bus operators are asked to do so much in this city. They take de-escalation training courses So while they are driving and operating a bus, they're often also being asked to essentially kind of scale down a situation in which passengers may be going at each other. I've been on buses where I've seen the bus operators having to confront someone who is not paying their ticket as they're trying to do a better job of fare enforcement. So they're being put in a situation of having to not only move people across the city, but also confront people in ways that respectfully, the light rail operators really don't have to. So it's a really difficult situation for them.
Hunter.
Talk about a revealing investigation by the Observer here. I mean, the numbers from 2023 to now, there were 200 reported incidents to our bus operators. Now, only a small fraction of them actually ended up with assaults. But I wanted to point out, Mike, something that I did not know, even though we've all reported on these types of awful incidents, but the process and what our bus drivers do not have access to. So if somebody gets on board, starts threatening or actually assaults them, they are supposed to radio to bus operations and the center and let them know there have been problems. The problem with that is some people feel by the time help is even sent out, they could be dead. They are not allowed to carry a phone, a cell phone of any sort, so they can't even call 911 themselves. Now, that is a national, kind of a national trend on bus operators. That was a shock to me. And then supposedly some of them have been told that even if they see somebody who they know is banned trying to get on, they are told to let them ride because they can get in trouble for passing people at the stops and not letting them on. Mm.
Okay, moving on. As long as we're talking about transit, there was that horrible incident last August on the Blue Line with the murder of Irina Zarudzka and the man accused of committing that crime, DeCarlos Brown, has been found incompetent to stand trial in federal court. A state court had already reached that assessment. What will that mean, Hunter, for this case?
Yeah, so the big headline that I just want everybody to be clear on, this does not mean DeCarlos Brown is being released or getting put back out on the streets. He is found incompetent to stand trial for now. We see this often when we have defendants who have a mental health history. They have to go through these evaluations. He was actually sent to a prison up in Chicago where a psychiatric team actually basically evaluated him over a number of days. They looked into all of his medical files, and they found that he was just not there yet to be able to know entirely what's going on in the courtroom and the charges against him. So what will happen now, for the next 4 months, he will be sent to a hospital where he is to undergo treatment to try to restore his competency to see if he can stand trial in the future.
Of course, this decision like this is always frustrating, particularly for the family members of victims. But U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, Russ Ferguson, told WSOC-TV that this needs to be viewed as a necessary step.
This is a federal case, and we have to be sure that everything goes right in this case. We have to protect this case on appeal. We have to protect this case on post-conviction litigation. We have to give all the due process to the defendant that we can to make sure that Irina Zarudzka and her family gets justice at the end of the day. And this is a step in that process.
Hunter, you were in the courtroom and sat two rows behind DeCarlos Brown during this proceeding, and you witnessed his conduct during that proceeding. How would you describe it?
You knew that there was something mentally unstable with this man. There were several outbursts. His own defense attorneys were trying to calm him down. He had asked the judge if he had the same paperwork, the same letter that he had in front of him, sitting there two rows in front of me. And then he started talking about this stuff that he is dealing with. He said that he wanted to press charges against the judge. He said that the FBI needed to investigate this material that was in his body. So it's exactly what we have heard in our initial reporting after Irina Zarudzka was stabbed on the light rail system, of his interactions with police, where he talked about being controlled by something else. Mm.
Okay, well, they'll evaluate him, and then we'll find out what happens next a little bit down the line. The South Carolina governor's race heads to a runoff following Tuesday's primary, in which two prominent Republican politicians lost their bids in that race. The two House U.S. House members, Ralph Norman from Rock Hill and Nancy Mace, who I believe is from the Charleston area, will lose their seats in Congress because they decided to run for governor but lost. How surprising, Mary, were either of these losses that they wouldn't at least make a runoff?
Not entirely surprising, given the size of the field. There were about seven candidates vying for the GOP nod. And also just the polling, both Ralph Norman and Nancy Mace ended up about where they were in polling. That being said, the fact that they were both sitting members of Congress, folks who were in, have had multiple terms in Congress, definitely made it a little bit of a surprise. One sort of silver lining for Ralph Norman, if he should choose to stay in politics, he did win a couple of counties in his neck of the woods. So a little something he can hang his hat on there. He at least did well in his congressional district. But other than that, yeah, it looks like both of them will be out of office, at least in the immediate term.
Donald Trump endorsed Lieutenant Governor Pam Evett. Is it Evett or Evett? I don't know.
Evett.
Donald Trump endorsed her, and she won a spot in the runoff on Tuesday night.
South Carolina, you sent a message tonight. You spoke clearly, and you said, we want a business leader, an entrepreneur, somebody who has created jobs, somebody just like Donald Trump, who's going to bring the private sector experience to government.
Given Trump's low approval ratings, has his business experience proven to be a plus for government?
This has been a little bit of an odd case in South Carolina. We've seen throughout the primary so far this year that President Trump's endorsement has been extremely influential, but it was not enough to get the sitting lieutenant governor the nomination. She's going to a runoff, and there was a lot of infighting within the South Carolina Republican Party during this race about sort of the validity of that endorsement, what sort of behind-the-scenes deals may or may not have been struck in order to secure her that endorsement, and kind of who is the true MAGA candidate in the district or in the race. And I think that's something that's going to continue in this runoff. Her up against State Attorney General Alan Wilson. There's been a lot of debate about the fact that the lieutenant governor was not born in South Carolina, that she is a quote unquote transplant, which is a big point of contention in South Carolina these days, given the rapid population growth down that way. So it'll be interesting to see what sort of influence the president does or doesn't have in this runoff, especially compared to how much power he's wielded in other states this election cycle.
And as you mentioned, the runoff will be between the lieutenant governor and the attorney general for the state of South Carolina, Alan Wilson.
This is not something you get coronated for. This is not something you can inherit. Not everybody believes that. You have to fight for it. You have to earn the votes.
So he already earned the endorsement of former foe Nancy Mace. We heard that at the very beginning of the program. She said that the two had ironed out their differences, which often happens following one candidate's defeat and another candidate's victory. Will this endorsement of Nancy Mace help him in any way, do we think?
I don't think it hurts. Obviously, you know, she did have a block of voters in this primary. It could direct them that way. Ralph Norman has not made an endorsement yet. I asked him about that at his party on Tuesday night. He said he hadn't made a decision yet on whether he will weigh in, but in what's likely to be a much more consolidated field now that we're down to two candidates, it's, you know, these are folks could potentially make a difference.
Okay, for summer flyers, which is about to begin, the summer vacation season is underway. There's a new feature being used at TSA checkpoints at Charlotte Douglas. Hunter, pray tell us what it is.
Yeah, it's actually pretty neat. I've used it before. So instead of going up and being called on by the TSA personnel to come up with your ID, or sometimes I'm like, do you need my ID? Do you need my boarding pass? They no longer will be face-to-face with you. They will be monitoring these little machines that you walk up. You put your ID into it. It verifies who you are. It still takes a picture of you. And then it spits your ID out. The gates then open if you're approved. And you walk through to, of course, go through the baggage part of TSA. So I will say it's pretty quick. And this could alleviate some TSA personnel to go and do other TSA jobs when we have, of course, seen backup and TSA people not wanting to go to work, of course, after them not being paid for so much.
And your reaction seems to be positive. And Carter Langston, who's a spokesperson for TSA, told WFAE that that has been pretty much the reaction of all the passengers.
People are really happy with it. It does add quite a bit of efficiency in the checkpoint operation from several perspectives, time being one of them.
Meanwhile, Zach, speaking of Fast and High, Carowinds is installing a new record-breaking ride. It's a new water ride. It won't be ready till next year, so why are we talking about it now?
Well, it's going to be record-breaking, apparently. It's going to feature the tallest log flume, and it's got the highest reverse drop, I believe, and reverse camelback drop. A lot of records there that it's breaking.
Meanwhile, speaking of records, the Carolina Hurricanes won again last night. They're on their way to the Stanley Cup. If they win in Las Vegas on Sunday, they will have the cup in their hands. If they don't, they'll have to come back to Raleigh and play again, where they have been very well. They play very well in Raleigh, so we'll see what happens. Zachary Turner from WFAE, David Hodges, WBTV, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, Hunter Sines from WSOC-TV. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.